Everyone, welcome to minute 141 of season 8 of Movie Raw Minute, the daily podcast where we foobar our way through the 1998 Steven Spielberg award-winning film Saving Private Ryan, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again this season, it's been a while since he's been on, but I'm glad he's back, is Stephen J. Rubin, author, filmmaker, podcaster, film historian. Welcome back to the show after all these years, Steve. I guess you're waiting for another World War II movie.
I am, and I know what it's going to be. It's going to be a movie called Lucky Strike. And it's a Battle of the Bulge movie, and I'm forgetting the name of the filmmaker. He did The Last Castle with Robert Redford.
Rod Lurie.
Thank you. Thank you. Rod is a friend. I've had him on my podcast. He's done a Battle of the Bulge movie, so we're very excited about that. There's always a World War II movie in the mix. In fact, World War II movies are kind of like James Bond movies. We're always going to have them.
Okay, and I know you're a big James Bond fan. You wrote a book about James Bond. So
I wrote six books about James Bond.
I'm sorry. I apologize. I didn't mean to offend.
No offense whatsoever. I've done four editions of the James Bond movie encyclopedia. The latest includes No Time to Die, and I wrote the first behind-the-scenes history of the Bond movies called The James Bond Films, A Behind-the-Scenes History. But more important, my very first book, as you know, was Combat Films, American Realism, 1945 mm-hmm. to 1970, which was updated to make it 1945 to 2010, which included a chapter on Saving Private Ryan.
Surprise, surprise. Yeah.
By the way, we're talking today about my favorite World War II movie.
I'm glad. It's awesome. It's one of my favorites. I mean, again, well, people have to wait until the final episode this season to find out, you know, my top five World War II movies. Obviously, anyone can guess that Saving Private Ryan will be on that list. You know, question is where. You know, question is where will it be on that list? Then you'll just have to wait another 28 episodes to find out. You know, so a little over a month from now, you know, on D-Day itself, you can find out.
The sign of a favorite movie is if it's streaming anytime and you're going through your surfing and you come across it, you stop. And invariably, if Saving Private Ryan is streaming, I am stopped.
See, I have a problem with that because I'm a completionist. If I watch a movie, I want to watch it from beginning to end. You know, so if I were to see that it's on somewhere, then I'll go look for it elsewhere where I can start it from the beginning. That's my problem.
No, that's fair. I think that
even if it's a movie I've seen dozens of times, you know.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, if I've seen it, I feel like I've already watched it. For instance, Gladiator, which is another great movie, Ridley Scott. I always seem to stop at the moment where Maximus reveals himself in the ring to the Emperor, and it's just one of my favorite movie moments. Period.
Okay,
and I love watching that moment. And I have to say that as much as I love Gladiator, every time Joaquin Phoenix comes on, I want to fast forward him because he's too slow.
Well, it's deliberate, but whatever. That's what can I tell you? So actually, why don't you start by telling people your history with this movie? Do you remember the first time you saw it? I mean, you've already let the cat out of the bag that it is your favorite World War II movie. But, you know, do you remember when you saw it? How often do you usually watch it on your own volition? I mean, again, you said that anytime you're flipping through the channels and you see it, you'll continue to watch it. But in general, like, is there a certain time of year that you know, I don't know, on D-Day, on Veterans Day, on Memorial Day, you know, I don't know.
To answer your first question, the first time I saw Saving Private Ryan was opening weekend back in 1998 at the National Theater in Westwood, Los Angeles, which is no longer there, by the way. It was torn down years ago. A big, big movie palace type theater, not an old time palace, a rather new palace, but I saw it on the big screen. I remember vividly buying, as I usually do when I walk into a movie theater, I buy popcorn. And I remember vividly during the first 25 minutes of Saving Private Ryan, I did not eat one kernel of popcorn.
Wow.
You know, I almost felt like it was sacrilegious to eat something while I'm watching American soldiers getting obliterated on Omaha Beach. It's funny. You often hear the term, it was a jaw-dropping moment when you're watching a movie. Well, that first 25 minutes of Saving Private Ryan was jaw-dropping and unforgettable. And I went with a whole group of people, and it was a great, awesome moment. Now, I at that time, I was developing a feature film based on the ABC television series Combat. I had the rights to the original series from ABC, and I was unfortunately, the fortunate part is I did sell the project, but I sold it to the wrong company. I sold it to a company called Savoy,
You should have
which
sold
is
it
a
to DreamWorks.
No, of course, of course. Well, what happened was Savoy went out of business, and we ended up selling it to Sherry Lansing at Paramount. And if you see the timeline, we arrived at the studio with a lot of fanfare, and then Saving Private Ryan arrived at the studio with a lot of fanfare. We went into the drawer for 7 years. Saving Private Ryan, Road to Glory. And to this day, I'm a little envious, but considering the quality of the movie, I don't mind that they beat us to the trick. And someday, maybe I'll be able to get my combat movie made.
You still have the rights?
No,
Oh,
they tripled the option payment number. So instead of spending 10 grand a year, they wanted 30 grand a year. And I said, no, thank you.
okay. That's fair. That's fair. Have you seen the movie in the theater? Have you seen this movie in the theater since the original your original viewing in 98?
Yes, at the Arrow Theater in Santa Monica, Adam Goldberg came by, and the two of us got a chance to chat before the movie began,
Oh, wow.
and had a fun time with Adam. And we'll talk about Adam today because he's part of the minutes I watched. You know,
Oh, yeah.
he's
Well, not just today, all week we're going to talk about him, you know.
right, exactly. And then in 2018. I contacted the LA Times, who I had sold some stories to in the past. I said, would you guys be interested in a 20th anniversary article on the making of Saving Private Ryan? And I got a very enthusiastic response. And with that ammunition, I started to get in touch with everybody. And I knew Steven Spielberg's publicist very well because I started my career in PR at the very beginning with Marvin Levy's son, Don. So Marvin got me in touch with Steven, and here's a funny story. You know, getting an interview with Steven Spielberg is no easy task.
Probably not.
Marvin said he would make it best efforts. So that summer, my family and I went to Scotland, and we did a European trip, and we're in the middle of Scotland. I get a f phone call from Marvin saying, Stephen, talk to Stephen tomorrow for 10 minutes. I'm in the middle of Scotland, in the middle of a small town. I was just terrified that I would have a lousy signal on my phone, but it all worked out nice. And instead of getting 10 minutes with Stephen, I think I got 28 minutes with Stephen.
Oh, wow.
I think I impressed him with my knowledge of World War II movies, and we kept on talking and talking and talking. And once I got Stephen, then I got Tom Hanks. And then once I got Tom Hanks, I started to get everybody. I think the only person on the show of note that I didn't get to talk to was Matt Damon. I could not get to Matt Damon, but I had some wonderful interviews with the entire cast. I remember, it's funny, Barry Pepper calls me from Europe because he hears that I'm trying to track him down. And I kept on disconnecting. I'm thinking it was one of those spam calls. So fortunately, I hooked up with Barry. So I mean, how could I do a story on Private Ryan without talking about Private Jackson? And I talked to Tom Sizemore. I talked to I had a brief conversation with Vin Diesel. Actually, Jeremy Davies, I couldn't chat with, but he answered questions for me through the email, so I was able to get those answered. So yeah, it was great, and the article came out that year, in 1998, on the 20th anniversary, and I got some very nice comments. In fact, I got a letter from Steven Spielberg thanking me for the article and glad that I had written it.
Oh, wow. That's really cool.
And I just really enjoyed the experience of writing about it. And one of the things over the years I've really prided myself on are these retrospective articles. My history with retrospectives goes all the way back to my days with Ciné Fantastique, the Chicago science fiction, horror, and fantasy film journal. My first one for them I did was on the movie Them, about the giant ants
Oh,
in the New
wow.
Mexican desert. And that was followed by a very long 6 months of research on the making of The Day the Earth Stood Still, where I got my very first fan letter. I got a letter from Leonard Maltin, of all people,
Oh, wow.
congratulating me on my research. So my thing about doing film retrospective articles is I go right to the sources. I don't just take people's information from previous interviews. I get to as many people as I can get to who are alive. And fortunately, with Private Ryan, that was everybody except, of course, Matt Damon.
Well, he's alive. He just wasn't. He wasn't. Bu he was just busy.
He was available. He's very much alive, but he wasn't available.
Exactly.
It's funny. I also spoke to Dale Dye, and
Wow.
Dale Dye obviously was very critical to the whole movie because he was the one who trained all the actors. And I got to ask all the actors about the training procedure. And they referred to it as, the boot camp, where they got to march into the woods and camp outside and go on hunter destroyer missions. And it was quite physical. And very important for the melding of the group, because those guys, after a week of hoofing it in the bush, they were a welded team.
Oh, wow.
And I enjoyed that aspect of it. And Di, there's a lot of things we can talk about with Saving Private Ryan, Rob. I think one of my favorite discussion points is the script language. I mean, this was a World War II movie that had descriptive language that soldiers took that we had never heard before, not in a World War II movie. I mean, the perfect example is when Captain Miller is doing the debrief with his commanding officer, played very beautifully by Dennis Farina. The language they're speaking about the technical aspects of securing a section of Normandy after a successful battle with 88 millimeter German artillery pieces. Just their banter is very, very sophisticated for a World War II movie. And then throughout the movie, we hear phrases that just made the movie much more realistic for me. And some of the stuff seemed a little contemporary. For instance, when we first meet General Marshall, and Dale Dye's character comes in to brief him on how chaotic the airborne landings were in Normandy. He's talking about, talking about Ryan. Oh, he's probably KIA. Well, I've
Right.
never in a World War II movie ever heard anybody referred to as a KIA. I mean, that seems very Vietnam era, but apparently they researched it, and it was true to form. But when you do a Steven Spielberg movie, you don't mess around with the history. For instance, if Steven Spielberg had directed Patton, instead of Frank Schaffner, who did a beautiful job, I doubt if he would have made the main battle tank of the Nazis the M60 Patton tank, which they put the crosses on. I think what was cool about Saving Private Ryan is that all the hardware in the movie was as close to realistic as possible. Sherman tanks, Tiger tanks, Panther tanks, tank destroyers, 20 millimeters. I mean, this is all very realistic stuff. And that's another aspect of the movie I really appreciated. I mean, I go back to, I mean, Kelly's Heroes for me was a great World War II movie because it had original stuff. There were a bunch of Sherman tanks there, not a bunch of modern tanks.
Right. Okay. I mean, it makes sense. I mean, that's one of the reasons why this movie is so great. Because it puts you right there in the action and you feel as if this is all very realistic with everything that's going on. Which is great. So minute 141 begins with Ryben continuing with his diversion and ends with Upham Seeking safe passage. So basically, we ended things on Friday with unfortunately we lost Jackson, and you know, the battle is continuing. You know, the battle of Rommel, and at the end of Friday's episode, Ryben decides he's going to go do something heroic in order to take out the 50 caliber, or the 30 caliber.
The 20 millimeter?
20 millimeter. There you go. 20 millimeter. That's what it is.
Yeah, that as he's saying to Miller, that 20 millimeter is killing us.
Right.
As it wiped out everybody on the tank. It was, yeah, it was crazy. You know, Ed Burns is fun to interview, talking about, you know, carrying the BIR. And I guess at one point while he was filming, he'd been firing it steadily, and it got very hot, and I think it almost burned his hands. I think that was one of his strongest memories of carrying the BAR.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. He's a great character. He's a kind of, you know, he's not exactly enamored with this whole mission, as he states continuously, you know, what the hell are we doing here?
That's right.
But then again, he grows to respect Ryan, and of course, they have that kind of moment. Just before he leaves the foxhole, he looks over at,
and he nods his head at him,
gives him that little nod, like, "Okay, man, we're in this together. I'm backing you. Don't worry." That kind of thing. And I thought that was very effective. There's a lot of little nuance in this movie that you watch over and over and over again, and you really get to appreciate. You know, we can, I don't know if, do you want, is it okay if I mention a little bit about the opening 20 minutes that I first saw?
Sure, feel free.
I mean, I grew up with a movie called The Longest Day, which we're all familiar with. I mean, that for me was the first big World War II movie I saw in the theaters. That was a movie palace experience at the old Carthay Circle Theater in Los Angeles. I remember, I was, let's see, in 62, I was probably 10 years old. And I remember seeing the giant posters and blow-ups of the actors, because, you know, Longest Day has 42 stars in it. It's one of the biggest celebrity casts in history.
Yeah.
And of course, they do Omaha Beach. And I thought, It's still one of my favorite movies. I think the logistics of doing The Longest Day were enormous, and I think that their ability to recreate the invasion was really beautifully done, although entirely different from the landing in Saving Private Ryan. The landing, the beach in Saving Private Ryan is not very big.
And it's also very bloody, and it's in The Longest Day, you don't see the blood flowing the way that you do here.
It's exactly, it's bloodless. Yeah. Of course, the difference between 1962 and 1998 is enormous in terms of realism. I mean,
The Longest Day did have actors who were at D-Day themselves, you know.
Right.
So
right,
that I always find really amazing. Now, I mean, my biggest complaint about The Longest Day is that even if the movie is over 3 hours, it's still too short, because there's there are certain sequences that it just goes through too quickly, that it would have been so much better. You know, again, there's very little that you can complain about such a comprehensive movie, you know, except for the fact that it would be even better if it was more comprehensive. You know,
oh, sure, sure. And it's interesting because that movie was filmed and released in black and white. Saving Private Ryan was filmed and released in color. So it's funny. Normally, I believe that some of my favorite World War II movies are my favorite World War II movies because they're in black and white. They feel so much of the period. And I think that color World War II movies look a little too clean for me. Saving Private Ryan doesn't have that clean look that takes you out of the movie. It's funny because most of us never saw color World War II footage until George Stevens released his documentary.
Right.
About you know, his war experience as a correspondent, and featured the first color footage of the European battlefield most of us had ever seen. And I found it amazing to see his footage of the mayhem in Normandy. It was just incredible. I didn't picture it in color. I never pictured the war in Europe in color. It was a black and white war, right?
More or less, yeah.
Yeah, I mean that's what I mean. Most of the World War II movies between 1938 and you know the 1960s and 70s were black and white pictures. And I anyway the black and white quality of The Longest Day gave it a documentary flavor, and also you have the performances. There's some terrific performances. Robert Mitchum's Norman Coda, the commander of the 20 assistant division commander of the 29th division, is just terrific. I was always a big Jeffrey Hunter fan when he tries to take out the pillbox. That was great. And then of course the Pointe du Hoc battle with all those young actors was terrific as well. But the we were unprepared for how Spielberg was going to shoot Saving Private Ryan. Now, Spielberg has always been a director that is interested in getting you right into the action. The best example of that is Jaws.
True.
You are in the water. You are in the water with that girl swimming at the beginning. And when she gets that first, thing from the shark, you feel that in your bones. And later on, when you're on the beach with all those bathers and you're in the water, Spielberg has the camera right in the water. So that should prepare you right away for how he's going to shoot the Normandy invasion. This is not going to be a series of long shots, although there are a few of those, but he is going to get you right into it. And I'll tell you that opening sequence, they're all on the landing craft. He's showing the various faces of the infantrymen. You obviously have Captain Miller, the Tom Hanks character, about to send his men onto the beach. And then they realize very quickly that if they get onto the beach, if they just go straight ahead, they're going to be killed. So he goes over the side. All of his men go over the side, which saves their life. And then you're in the water again, where Spielberg seems to be very comfortable. And the use of sound is fascinating because when Hanks's character, Captain Miller's in the water, you're not hearing things directly, or they're muffled because his ears are plugged, or there's a concussion. In fact, when a motor bomb explodes, he feels the concussion affects the sound again. And it happens a few times. It happens later on in Rommel. Just really intense. To this day, I have no idea how anybody got off that beach.
Yeah, seriously. And having watched The Longest Day and any other movie about D-Day, until you saw it here, you weren't as scared about everything that's happening on that beach. You know that it was hell, but until Spielberg did it, you didn't realize how devastating it was. I mean, again, I've heard stories of World War II veterans that got up and walked out of the movie. Because it just was so realistic to them. It made them remember what they had gone through.
Some of Spielberg told me that some of the veterans he talked to before he started shooting, he asked them very specific questions. And when they were lying in the sand, hugging in the sand, trying to not be struck by a bullet, every time there was a mortar bomb, the whole you know the ground would shake horribly, almost like an earthquake. And they remembered that earthquake feeling. And I guess the situation is you put enough men on a beach that the Germans aren't going to be able to kill everybody. And interestingly, the guys found shelter behind some of those beach obstacles,
Yeah,
which actually saved probably quite a few
it's
lives
like the
because
Czech. What were they called? The Czech. I talked about this the first week of this podcast. I can't remember what it's called.
anyway, they provided some form of cover. It's interesting in watching that sequence also, I asked this on Quora. I don't know if you're familiar with Quora. It's one of these websites where you can ask questions on any topic, and I have a lot of military veterans who answer questions. And I was wondering whether the bazookas, because you don't see any bazookas firing on the beach, and you wonder how effective a bazooka would have been against those pillboxes, because obviously the shot has to go right in the middle of that. The it was just, Rommel built those pillboxes very carefully, so they, whereas the other beaches were not as nearly as covered as Omaha. Omaha right. was covered everywhere. So that was pretty intense.
Right. And they're called Czech hedgehogs. That's what they're called.
Czech hedgehogs. There you go.
Yeah. Right. Okay. So, like I said, Ryben is continuing to be heroic. He's just, you know, shooting his BIR, running across, trying to find some cover. We see him hit a lot of the Germans as he's running across. And then he reaches like a mound of rubble, and we hear the sounds around him of some sort of you know tank coming, and he runs away and then runs into the safety of a building, and then the shot changes, and we're back with Henderson and Mellish as they're you know shooting through that big huge hole in the apartment that they're holed up in.
And, yeah, and every time the Germans throw a potato masher in there, they grab it and throw it back out, and they knock off
right.
a few more.
It's great,
but it's
you know, and I mean, I to me watching this now, I don't know if you've heard. I mean, I try not to get political or anything like that, but this reminds me of a story from October 7th. You know that there was a guy. There were about 20 people that were in a bomb shelter. And the terrorists threw in 8 grenades that one of the guys who was standing at the doorway grabbed and threw back out, you know, and the 8th one was the one that actually got him. But it just goes to show that what they're doing here is realistic, because it's something that can happen in real life also. You know, you do have those few extra seconds to throw it back, you know, if you're on the ball, you know, that type of thing.
Unfortunately, eventually they make the mistake. I think, is it Max Martini, Adam Goldberg's buddy? Yeah, Martini's character, just forgets to take cover and takes a bullet hit in the throat, which knocks
okay, well,
him
great.
Out.
We're not there yet. We're almost there.
Yeah.
No, that's okay.
Anyway.
And I mean, throughout this scene, we hear both Henderson and Ryben screaming for Upham. You know, they're out of bullets, and they're Upham ammo. God damn it! You know, and they show us in this minute a lot of shots of Jeremy Davies of Upham just cowering on the side, scared out of his wits. You know, we see he's got the ammo on him, but
I'm yelling at the screen. I say, just run to the stairway. Run to the stairway.
That's right.
And for some reason, he's frozen. He can't head for the stairway. He looks to it. He moves a little bit to his that would be his right, and he sees the Germans coming up the side of the building. And he, again, they ignore him or they don't see him. And then, of course, he starts heading for the stairs.
Right. Okay. Well, right. That'll be not in today's minute, but. But he throughout this minute, he's just frozen in place. And then we get another shot of Miller, you know, shooting. And then Upham actually gets the courage to run across the quad. And that he does. We see that he's got less ammo on him than he did before. I don't know if that's just a continuity error or if he dropped it, you know, before he got up to take a little bit less to get there. And then he's right by the stairs, and he sees the stairs where he needs to go up, but he just can't do it. And as this minute ends, you know, we basically see him trying to see if it's safe to go up those stairs, and he doesn't know. And we end this minute with the shock on his face, just not knowing whether he should be doing this or not. You know, and it's just great because, again, the way that Spielberg shoots this movie gives us the emotional feelings of these characters. You know, you feel his fear. And you, on the one hand, scream at him because why is he doing that? But on the other hand, you can also still understand his fear empathize with the fact that he's not going. But on the other hand, we know that he's supposed to be going to go help out, Henderson.
Exactly. In my questions to Jeremy, I asked him about his character, and Jeremy said that shortly after they started shooting the movie, Spielberg realized that Upham is the audience. Of all the characters, Upham is the character through which the audience sees the story. And he's the observer, he's the neophyte, he's the audience. So his character's journey reaches a pinnacle in his terror. The audience feels that terror and feels his fear. And I think it's perfectly realized in Jeremy Davies' performance. I think Jeremy Davies is, he's a typist, for God's sake. He tells Miller, because should I bring my typewriter with him? You know, come on, he's not a combat soldier. Jeremy, the character of Upham should not have been anywhere near that battlefield.
That's
But
right.
because they needed an interpreter, because their interpreter was killed on the beach in Normandy, Miller has to get an interpreter. And Upham is very.
I always loved the little tidbit of the fact that, you know, we Tom Hanks's character Miller comes across two different typewriters in this movie. You know, at the beginning, there's one on the beach where there's a, you know, a guy with typewriter. There are guys with typewriters. He said, "Get rid of that and grab a gun." And then when he meets Upham, and anyone who knows anything about Tom Hanks knows that he loves typewriters. He's a typewriter collector. So, you know, I always wonder if it's something that Tom Hanks asked to put in there. You know, you know,
Of all things
and
to collect.
knowing Tom Hanks, he probably, you know, took the you know, took the props with him to add to his collection.
May very well be. It's funny because I have to laugh. I'm on the phone with Tom Hanks. I thought I was talking to him somewhere in the islands because he was supposedly on vacation, but it turned out I was talking to him about 4 miles away. He was in the Palisades. I think his house did survive along with Spielberg's for the fires. But I had him on the phone for about 20 minutes talking about Saving Private Ryan. But you know, I've got Tom Hanks on the phone. And this is a little bit of an aside. I said, Tom, at the end of Castaway, when you're standing on that crossroads and the girl is driving off in her little pickup truck, you go after her, right? And he wouldn't add, he said, what do you think? So I always thought, because you know that he's going to go after that girl. I mean, he's been holding on to that FedEx package for 4 years. He's already dropped it off at her front doorstep, but he's now that he sees that she's a honey bunny, he's got to go after her. But that was fun.
Yeah, for sure. All right, and that's how this minute ends. Is there anything else you want to say about this minute?
Well, I think we should talk a little bit about the location. I think that,
Well, why don't we
you
wait
know.
till tomorrow and talk about the location tomorrow? We'll still
Okay.
be there, you know.
Very good. Very good.
All right. So every Monday we have a segment called Maestro Monday, where my guests will give their top five John Williams themes, scores, however you want to look at that. So, Steve, why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
Okay, I would probably put number five because I look at the albums I collected as a kid. I would put number five, The Fury, which is not one of his better known scores, but a really good score, a very powerful score. I love The Fury, which is not a very good movie, by the way. It's a movie that I don't think works, but like a lot of movies, the music works, but the movie doesn't. I would say that number two,
Number four.
number four, I would have to say Superman, which I just watched again recently. I'm a big Superman fan. I think Superman drives that movie, the music of Williams. Star Wars would be number three. I mean, my God, there's so much Star Wars music over the years. It'd have to be number three. My number two is a score that I really like from another World War II movie, Empire Strikes, excuse me, Empire Strikes Back. No,
Empire of the Sun.
Empire of the Sun, thank you. And I thought that's a very understated score, but really beautifully done. That, by the way, is probably my favorite. Well, I'll get into this later because we're going to talk about Spielberg because it's one of my favorite Spielberg movies. And then I think my favorite Spielberg score is, of course, Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Very cool. All right. So would you like to tell people how they can get in touch with you?
I have a number of ways of getting in touch with me. I have two podcasts. Stephen J. Rubin's Saturday Night at the Movies is on your local podcast platform. It's also a YouTube channel. I am on Facebook, Stephen J. Rubin, J-A-Y Rubin, R-U-B-I-N. I'm on LinkedIn, Stephen J. Rubin. I'm on Instagram, Stephen. Actually, I think my Instagram account is Fast Carrier, which is the name of my production company, Fast Carrier Pictures. And I also have an X account, which is Stephen J. Rubin. And if anybody literally wants to write me an email, I do respond to emails, Steve, StevJayRubin@gmail.com.
Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on my website, MovieRobMinute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to MovieRobMinute@MovieRob.net. Until tomorrow, earn this.
Earn this. My solitude.